We're talking about the Twin Ports Transportation Hub. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, coming to you live from our studios in Superior. Duluth Superior moves about 35 million short tons of cargo annually, ranking among the nation's top 25 ports. It anchors the Great Lakes, St. Lawrence Seaway system, so it's a really important access point for domestic and global trade. And we're going to learn about how cargo moves through Lake Superior and beyond. Do you work in transportation and logistics? What are the challenges to move cargo on budget and on time? We're at 800-642-1234 to join the conversation. Richard Stewart teaches transportation and logistics management and is director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center at UW-Superior. Richard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So when we talk logistics, moving cargo, it's so much about data and numbers driven and the information and the money and the timing. But before we break that down, take us to the heartbeat of transportation in the Twin Ports. Set the scene for us. What is the Port of Duluth Superior like on a given day?
Well, the first thing that I'm going to say, that transportation in the Twin Ports has historically always been multimodal. And what I mean by that is that the rail connects with the marine, highways connect. They all come together at this hub. And if you step back into space and take a look at this area, you'll see we're right in the heart of North America. And we can move cargo by all five modes of transportation. We have pipelines that connect us to Alberta. Most people don't realize that in a neighborhood of 17% of all the oil that's imported into the United States comes through Superior, Wisconsin. We have major gas pipelines coming here. We have the only refinery in the state of Wisconsin. And when that refinery is operational and producing product,
Husky,
that product has to move out by rail. There was a time it moved out by ship for many years, but that's no longer done out of this port. But it moves out by rail, and it moves out by vehicle, and so it continues down by pipeline.
Nearly a fifth of all U.S. oil imports come through Superior. How did Superior come to be such an access point for oil and natural gas?
When they discovered the Alberta oil fields back about 1947, they built the first pipeline to connect to Superior in 1949. That pipeline is about that old and is a subject of much debate and probably a different program that needs to be replaced, but it connected with Superior because they could then move it to the lower lakes by vessel. And we moved most of the oil by vessel for several decades until they connected other pipelines that ran to Montreal, Toronto, down to Chicago.
So when you talk about the different modes of transportation coming together in the Twin Ports region, you know, we think of trucking and we certainly think of the waterways. We have this port, the pipelines, as you mentioned, there's railroad, there's air. How unique is that for a region to have all of those different options on the table?
Well, we could do a little comparative here in Wisconsin. We could look at Madison. Most people have heard of Madison.
And carry on.
If we take a look at Madison, you'll find that they have a railroad that comes into Madison, the Wisconsin Southern Railroad. Very good railroad, but it's a regional carrier. We have four Class I railroads that call here, which gives us access to all the coasts and of the United States direct from here. We have a major port, as you pointed out, which Madison does not have. We have the pipeline system and all the tank farms that go with it. We could connect by four-lane highway direct to Madison. When I drive down to Madison, once I leave Superior, I don't hit a stoplight until I'm in Madison. So it's a very smooth transition to move down by truck. But Madison also, well, it has an airport and a very good airport. We have an airport of equal size served by three major carriers, but we also have a seaplane base with Sky Harbor. We have another general aviation airport with Bong. And the Twin Ports are the largest manufacturer of single-engine airplanes in the United States with Cirrus Aircraft. And when you bring that together, it's what we call a cluster from Porter's cluster theory, and we bring together all this expertise in transportation. We bring together the knowledge base, and that's a dynamic that you only get in a true transportation hub.
When you look at the economics of that true transportation hub, what does that mean for this region?
Well, recent study was done by the Port of Duluth, and it amounts to hundreds of millions of dollars in benefits just for the marine side alone. The airport just did an economic study looking at the air side of it. Once again, hundreds of millions of dollars and thousands of jobs.
Talking with Richard Stewart, he teaches transportation and logistics management, is director of the Transportation Logistics Research Center at UW-Superior. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Perhaps you work in transportation as a truck driver. Maybe you work at a port. What are some of the challenges you face, and how has your work changed as different modes of transportation have come online and changed? And what is the toughest part of the job? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Richard, you can have all of these different options for transportation on the table, but how hard is it to get them to interface, to connect with one another, to actually create a hub?
That interconnectivity is critical. We just recently developed in Duluth the intermodal terminal. Intermodal is where you use a unitized container, and it transfers between ship, truck, rail. This has proven to be extraordinarily successful, but we have created here in the Twin Ports in the Great Lakes one of the most fabulous systems of transportation. And I've traveled all over the world studying this. We bring in the iron ore, the taconite, by rail, directly loaded into the ships. The ships, the self-unloaders, are unable to unload that cargo in the lower lakes at thousands of tons an hour, proving to be one of the most efficient systems there is. And when we speak of the five modes, I always add in the sixth mode, and that's people power. When you talk about interconnectivity, we need to make certain that people who are walking, people who are taking buses, people who are riding bikes, have that interconnectivity as well as moving taconite. We can get that first and last mile of transportation linked together.
What have you seen in terms of the opportunities and challenges that automation brings to this system of transportation and logistics?
Automation is still just over the horizon. And I'm going to say automation as we think of it, and that's a hands-off driving. All of us are embracing automation in our automobiles. We'll have cruise control, and now, which is a form of automation. It can now be coupled with side scan, so you could tell if you're changing lanes and someone's nearby. You can have an automatic braking system and a cruise control in your car, and the car will stop when it sees another vehicle. You've taken no action. There's five levels of automation that the automotive engineers look at. We're really at about level two. Level three, we've had experiments in the United States and truck platooning in other areas where you could, one truck locks into another truck through wireless systems. They'll follow about 10 meters apart, which is much, much closer than trucks normally go.
But because they can talk with each other, the systems can communicate, they know it's safe.
Yes, and let's be clear, it's not the humans communicating.
It's the computers.
It's the computers communicating. The Europeans have done this also. Truck platooning may be one of the first types of automation that we see. It's still in the experimental stage. We have been looking at it in Wisconsin DOT and the Minnesota DOT.
Well, let's bring in a call here on this. Let's go to Mike in DeForest. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I have a question on trucking. With this 12-hour rule I'm hearing about, it seems like no matter what the weather, the trucks will not slow down, and we're having multiple truck wrecks. I've seen they pass me in snow-covered roads just as fast as they can go. Is that 12-hour thing got anything to do with that?
Can you explain the 12-hour rule, Richard?
Yes, Mike. What you're referring to is what they call the hours of service rule. It was enacted with the goal of not having fatigued truck drivers on the highway. And it's pretty rigorously enforced. They must keep a logbook. It had been paper log. Effective this year, it's become an electronic log for almost all trucks so that State Patrol can verify that the truck driver took their hours of service break so they're not fatigued. That's an issue that's separate from the speed at which trucks go. The reality is that there's little benefit in a truck going fast because the energy consumption on the truck is very high. Many large trucking companies put governors in the truck so that the truck cannot exceed the speed limit. I'm not going to say there's not trucks at speed, just as there's cars at speed and go beyond the speed limit.
We're talking transportation and logistics in the Twin Ports, Superior and Duluth, which together are considered the largest freshwater port in the world. Richard Stewart is our guide. He is the head of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center here at UW-Superior. Getting your thoughts, your questions, they're welcome, 800-642-1234. Do you work at a port or in transportation? What are some of the issues facing the industry? Is it safety? Is it a shortage of workers? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back to this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about transportation and moving cargo through the Twin Ports. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're broadcasting from our Superior Bureau. The port of Duluth Superior finished last year's shipping season strong. International shipping through the St. Lawrence Seaway in and out of the Great Lakes had its best year in more than a decade. We're talking about transportation, about logistics, with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Are you perhaps a truck driver, or do you want to work for another type of transportation? What do you want to tell us about your job? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Richard Stewart is our guide, and he teaches transportation and logistics management at UW-Superior. Let's go back to the phones now with Caleb joining us in Madison. Hi, Caleb.
Hi, I was just wondering if your guest could speak to the environmental and subsequent economical impacts that invasive species have from ballast water from global trade ships.
So first of all, let's talk about what ballast water is. Can you describe that for us, Richard?
I certainly can. Ballast water, when a ship is empty of cargo, in order for it to be stable in the water and for its propeller to be immersed, it has to have some weight in the ship. At one time, we used to carry stones. When we converted to pumps, we used water, and we usually take up the water in whatever local area we're in. We did not understand the science behind it in taking on water in, say, the Black Sea and bringing it to the Great Lakes that we were transferring species. When that became recognized, the industry started to do voluntarily what we call mid-ocean ballast exchange, where we put salt water in it to kill the species. That's now required for ships entering the seaway. And it's proven to be quite effective, but unfortunately the genie was out of the bottle already. And we had zebra mussels, for example, and many other species that came in with the ballast water. And it has caused severe economic damage on the Great Lakes, and it also has impacted other species.
In what way of the economic damage?
Well, the zebra mussels, for example, will block intake pipes. They adhere to, which costs millions of dollars to have them removed so that power plants can have access to water. they'll cover under sunken wrecks. Divers can't get at them in the tourist trade. And they, of course, can be brought inland, not by ocean-going ships, but by recreational boaters to inland lakes where they'll have significant damage there because they filter out the water, removing the food for other species.
Well, as we talk about shipping and the environment, as Caleb talked about here, in 2020, ocean shippers have tighter emission standards. What do we know there?
The International Maritime Organization, of which we're signatory to the treaties, will require that fuel have only 0.5% sulfur in it in January of 2020. When that comes into effect, ocean ships will have a couple of options. They may elect to burn that fuel, which is a fuel used by trucks and railroads. It will be an expensive operation. They may also install scrubbers, which remove the particulate matter from the stacks. Interestingly enough, you have two types of scrubber systems, open and closed. An open one has the wastewater go directly into the sea. Not only is that banned on the Great Lakes to use open scrubbers, but significantly, ports such as Singapore have declared that they will not allow no open scrubber ships with open scrubber systems to call it to ports. So what you're starting to see worldwide is an ever-tightening restriction on air emissions and other types of emissions, fluids, waters from ships. This all falls under what we call the MARPOL, the Marine Pollution Regulations.
Let's go to Peter now, joining us from Racine. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I'd like to know, where does a person go to view some of these vessels that are entering the ports and the flags and nations where they originate from?
Let's talk about Duluth Superior. Probably the best place to go is the Duluth Ship Canal. There's actually a marine museum right there where you could go up and watch the ships come in and out of the harbor. And every day the Duluth News Tribune prints what ships are going to come in and out of the harbor and what time, so you could coordinate your visit. Down in the Port of Milwaukee, you can also view the ships. They have far fewer ships coming in and out. So my suggestion is you contact the port ahead of time to get some idea.
Well, when you look at the industry here, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics estimated that transportation-related fields are growing 6% from 2016 to 2026, adding hundreds of thousands of new jobs. What can we attribute to this trend?
A couple of things are happening. First of all, the baby boomers are retiring. And that's going to leave a big gap in knowledgeable, qualified people. And unfortunately, with a very few exceptions like here at UW-Superior, we haven't been training and teaching people about education in our state systems, state school systems for many years. And so there's a shortage of these knowledgeable, qualified people.
I want to make sure we get to safety here before we have to end the conversation. Whether you're shipping goods or cargo, you know, you're getting people and things from point A to point B. When you look at the safety record of transportation and logistics management, how can we ensure that there is safety in all aspects of this process?
The first thing that we preach is that safety is paramount. It is the single most important aspect of transportation. That being said, 80% of all accidents are usually involved with human error. And having people who are qualified and respected for the work they're doing by the general community enhances that feeling of wanting to do a quality job. We have put together automations to help out with this, but we still have, in my opinion, too many accidents because we should have zero accidents in the field. So it's a combination of training, education, safety issues. An earlier caller mentioned truckers speeding. Statistically, the only thing that speeding truck gains is a loss of money and possibly a loss of life. So it's much better to be following the speed limits for all vehicles in all modes of transportation.
How is all of these modes of transportation impacted by tourism? There was a push last year, last summer, a campaign to draw more cruise ship tourism to the Great Lakes with stops in Duluth. What happens when the Twin Ports become a tourist draw?
Well, I believe the Twin Ports has historically always been a tourist draw. And it's interesting, your comment about how do we connect tourism to transportation. You can't have tourism without transportation. Either they come in by rail, they come in by air. Tourists, by their very nature, must use transportation to get around. One of the best things we could do in any community is enable those tourists to arrive at their destination and get around easily with minimal environmental impact.
So when you look ahead on all of these modes of transportation, where do you see areas for growth and innovation? Where does it go from here for Duluth Superior?
We are going to see a continued demand in the Asian market. I believe that we're going to see the intermodal traffic that we have here in Duluth grow to that Asian market. The demand for goods pulls transportation. The demand for passenger service pulls transportation. Both of those are growing constantly. We may see some opportunities as climate change comes and impacts transportation, which it has significant impact on transportation. We may see new opportunities crop up in the area for improved passenger rail service or improved maritime shipping. Think for a moment what it would be like if the Great Lakes were ice-free year-round.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Richard Stewart teaches transportation and logistics and is director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center at UW-Superior. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.